Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett. What you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with Ryan Smith. Now, Ryan is the owner of the Utah Jazz, as well as the founder and former CEO of Qualtrics, which sold to SAP for $8 billion, then went public and then sold again most recently to Silver Lake for $12 billion. Ryan and I discuss a bunch of different things, including what it's like to own his hometown team in the Jazz, how that came to be, the sale process of buying into the NBA, as well as the early days of Qualtrics. We go into Ryan's background, which involved him dropping out of high school, ending up in South Korea without knowing a single person in the country and without a job, as well as how his life was turned around. And ultimately, he found his way to founding Qualtrics with both his dad and brother. A really interesting conversation with a thoughtful leader. Here's my conversation with Ryan Smith.
All right, Ryan, thanks for doing this. Okay, so I want to take you back to 2017. You're asked a question in an interview. I don't know if you've ever been held account for this. You don't know where I'm going.
No.
You're asked in the interview, you said that you picked Russell Westbrook over Kevin Durant to start a team. Do you think at that moment the NBA owners were like, okay, good, we'll let this guy in? This is it.
Did I really say that?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I said
2017.
I picked Russell Westbrook over
I think it was during his MVP run and all of that. This kind of research you get from me.
Yeah, I like it. So first of all, I don't know, a lot changes. But, you know, I think then it was probably
just won an MVP award.
But what's crystal clear is you need both of them plus one more to win a championship.
So. That's certainly true. So wait, I want to ask about, so buying the Jazz. So you're the governor now, which I still haven't adjusted to. Have you gotten natural in saying governor versus?
I don't say anything.
You don't.
Yeah. I don't. That's everyone else's title.
Yeah, that's what other people say about it. Yeah. So the process of buying in, when did this actually start to be something that you were thinking about? Like, this could be a real thing. I assume at some point kids like want to play and then they're like, I'm not good enough. And then if you're lucky, you start to think maybe I can buy a team.
Yeah, I think there's a couple kind of evolutions of this. Number one is when unique to most people, when I've done Qualtrics for 22 years and we have this principle of all in, like you are all in. I didn't do anything else. I didn't own rental property. I didn't do one other thing. I didn't sit on boards. I didn't invest in tech companies. It was all Qualtrics all the time. The only thing that caught my interest was I'd fly down to like Summer League and go play golf with Danny Ainge, or we'd go meet up multiple times a year. And I started to understand like the back office of basketball.
And is this like 2012, 13,
this
14?
Is like 14, 15, 16, 17, 18.
So Qualtrics is a success at this point.
Yeah.
You're still the CEO.
Like, we're on the IPO roadshow. We're in Boston and we go into the locker room during a game. We're on a pre-roadshow and it's the playoffs and we planned it out so that we could hang out with Danny because it was just infectious. I loved the back office and the inner workings of the NBA. And so that's kind of where this kind of spurred. And then when we sold the company, I remember specifically telling everyone, like, sorry, like, it's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with your money? What are you going to do with this? How is this going to work? Like, everything came down to, well, I want to do something with the NBA, period, hard stop. And by that time, I had gotten to know Adam. We'd worked with the league. I'd been to All-Star games. I'd kind of been part of the NBA. And even within SAP, sitting on like the tech council of the NBA with SAP, it just happened. And then the process comes as like, okay, great. You and millions of other people want to be part of the NBA. How do you actually pull that off?
Yeah, and how do you differentiate? Because you came close twice, once.
So I took a look. I mean, I flew down and met with the folks in Phoenix, and there wasn't a majority position at the time there. It was more of a minority. And I kind of drew a circle around, hey, I need like a 2-hour radius around from where I live so that I could actually be helpful, hopefully. And I think Minnesota was on the outside of that, right? It was like 2 hours and 6 minutes. And that was one that I went pretty far down the road with Glenn Taylor on. And, you know, Utah was never in the cards.
Ashley was the one that convinced you. Your wife was like, hey, this isn't
our
thing.
Like, she just knows me. And like, I like to kind of really get in and go all in on this stuff. And she's like, we're never going to see. Like, you're never going to want, like, I know how this is going to go, and we're here. This is what we're doing. And it really, like, came, there was a couple moments where it came to fruition, like, okay, what about our jazz tickets? I was like, well, we can't have jazz tickets and own that part of that team. And she's like, yeah, that our kids are doing.
So you, it's a very practical implication.
Yeah, like,
but, and Adam told you at the time, like, hey, or maybe once you bought the Jazz, like, people don't get to buy their team. Yeah. And so you cross paths with Gail Miller, I assume, in this community here. And so are you, like, soft selling, hey, I'm a, you know, I'd be a good steward for the organization?
I don't know, though. I mean, I asked her point blank, and it wasn't a soft sell. It was like, hey, like, there's a moment in time. There's a window here. I'm willing to go do this. Like,
what year is this?
This is 2019.
And so at that point, it's in a trust. The Miller family put the Jazz in a trust.
The beginning of the year, beginning of 19, it was like, that's where it is. And the answer was not like, no, it was like, no way. It's been 35 years. Our family's going to run it. And then, you know, stuff changes. I mean, we had the pandemic. We had a lot happen in the league, the bubble. Like, I think it's just become a pretty hands-on sport. And I also believe that having like a little bit more consolidation in ownership group, like where there's a single individual to make a decision, helps a lot. And because you want to be nimble as an organization. And so I think as they started looking out, we started looking out that, you know, I got the call and said, hey, are you still interested? And it's like, absolutely.
And it was just a one-to-one kind of brokered.
Yeah. There was no process. There was no bid.
There's a really cool article that we can link in the show notes of her talking about her decision. I guess she gave like a pretty exclusive interview to the Deseret, whatever, paper here. And it was clear it was like an emotional decision
for
them. And I can only imagine the process on their side.
I mean, 35 years. I mean, we're going into year three.
Yeah.
And it would be emotional for us after year three. Like it is. You put your heart, your soul, your time, your games. It's like founding a company, except for the difference is like at the end of the day, people don't care about enterprise software. They care about this.
Yeah.
Like it is another level. I mean, we're going into the 50th anniversary of TouchPass this year, and the emotion of fans is, it's just a part of who they are. That's really the largest brand, you know, I think it's really the front door to Utah. And so I think wherever you go internationally, it's like, I mean, I was just in Croatia, you know, it's like Utah Jazz, like, oh, you're from Utah Jazz. And that's how people know you.
What's something different about like the customer base of a fan versus like the customer base of an enterprise software company? It sounds like the passion, the level of that. But like, do you think about communicating like the roadmap and the path you're on? And you guys obviously traded Donovan and Rudy Gobert. Yeah. And like, how do you think about the difference between those two?
You know, it's interesting you say that. I think, you know, there needs to be a confidence level, which I think is very similar, not only from a customer base, but an employee base if you're running a company. I think that, you know, you need to be able to show some sort of vision and innovation. I would say the difference between tech and sports is in tech, like 5 out of 10 is good enough. I mean, if you look at Salesforce market share, it's still below 50% and they're deemed the category winner. We don't have that. There's only one of 30 teams that's happy at the end of the year.
Yeah. The Jazz have been one of the most successful franchises.
Yeah, we're like the third winningest team.
But
in franchise, our second winningest team in the last 30 years, but we don't have a championship.
That's what everyone says is the but.
So, you know, the question is, can you be a championship organization without winning a championship? Technically, you should be able to win one out of every 30 years. But especially nowadays, it's almost like you have to purposely take a step back to put yourself in a position to win. And you got to get incredibly lucky, like incredibly lucky, especially if you're not in one of the markets that are maybe three in the NBA, which would be, you know, LA, Miami, maybe New York, but that's about it, right? Which we haven't seen either, right? And so I think this is what, there's a lot of differences there, but I also think there's a lot of advantages. Like our fan base loves the Jazz. we sold out like 251 straight games with, you know, okay teams and the best team, then a not as good team, like, and they're still there throughout it, which is a little bit different than tech and a customer base because, you know, renewal rates are all over the place. And I think there's another loyalty level that's here with the team. And, you know, I speak from the heart because that's me. Like, regardless, it's part of who I've been since I was a kid. And you can't take it out of me. And you don't really choose these things. Like, it's like, this is who you are.
Is there something you've learned that, like, is broadly applicable to business or tech that now you've been in this seat that, like, hey, basketball does this, and that's something that I wish more founders did as well?
Well, I think emotional, like, part of running a tech company, at least for a long time, right? I think running tech is great. Running tech for a long time is a different world. I mean, 22 years in tech feels like you started 7 or 8 companies because you're always just one good idea from someone else out there by being completely displaced. And so to be able to continually reinvent and find the energy to work on the same problem that long is a little bit different. And so I think the reason why I say that is because I think is you're able to take a little bit more of a long-term approach. You've been able to manage emotion maybe a little longer than other people. And I think as you get into the MBA, what you find is, you know, we've all been in tech or someone we worked with close or an executive, you know, chooses to leave or you got to break up. And it's super, what feels like a mountain or a hurdle you can't get by. And you think like, how are we ever going to move on as we shift gears to go from a $200 million company to a $600 million company? Or, you know, as some of my leaders say, like, or friends say, who are now $5 and $10 billion companies, there's a different group for every phase of that journey. And it just seems like insurmountable for people. I personally know founders who have sold their companies because they didn't want to have to get a new band together. I mean, these are companies we all know just saying, hey, look, you know what? I've worked with these people for 7 or 8 years. It's clearly that this isn't the team to go to the next level. You know what? I don't have it. I don't want to go get married, a whole new group of people, go build the offsites and go do it all together. In sports, all of that is public. And there's another level of emotion that goes into that where being on that side, now looking back at these insurmountable moments, they're not insurmountable. There's another level of that where you're doing that out in the public setting. And the decisions are actually much trickier because of it being a winner-takes-all game. If it was a market share game, you would probably behave differently. Or if you were just trying to make the playoffs every year because that made the money work and it made your stock not go down, you're playing the beat and raise model. You're not doing that in sports. And actually the beat and raise model frustrates people a lot. I would argue that our fans would rather see us like, I mean, we had fans cheering for us to obviously be worse than we were last year. But we also want to build a winning culture. And, so it's kind of an interesting dynamic, but yeah. There's a lot of learnings. I mean, I think the overlap is, it almost blends perfectly because I normally do tech during the day and basketball's at night, you know, play late games, kind of sleep in, you don't get to bed till late, you're on the road or whatever, and then you're back at it and shoot arounds at 3 or 4 o'clock. And then, well, tech is, for me at least, and I'm different, I'm not the rolling at 11 a.m. and stay up coding all night. I'm much more like we're starting at 6. Let's go.
So you brought in Danny Ainge. And there's a street in Barcelona that I went to once. It's called Las Ramblas. Have you ever been there?
Mm-mm.
It's like a little, they've got a bunch of little markets on either side. And whenever you go there, everyone says, like, be careful. There's pickpockets. And you'll get distracted.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went there. I was in college. I had never really got picked. Even though everyone told me I was going to get pickpocketed.
Yeah, yeah.
So Danny Ainge. So I bringing him in and working with him, it feels like he is the Las Ramblas of this, that he's just so good at what he does from a trade standpoint and like how he architects teams and all of that. Are there elements of style that he brings to bear just in negotiating or strategizing and all that you've really internalized from how he operates and the style around it?
Well, sure. I think first of all, for me, it's just, you know, we go back to tech. You know, we live in a culture in tech where it's like, surround yourself with the smartest people in the world. We don't care who's right. There's no ego. We typically have a flat, you know, org structure. We have an open office. You know, there's no offices at Qualtrics. Like, we've broken down a lot of the barriers that I would argue, even going into the NBA, like it felt a little bit like I was going back in time, because the hierarchy, and there's a reason for it in the league, which we can get into sometime, but it felt different. And so Danny is the ultimate person that you would want to work with in that tech environment. Here's someone who's been in the league for 46 years. There's no ego. He empowers everyone. He's the opposite of what you would think he would be, where, hey, don't worry, I got it. He's incredibly collaborative. So from the interns down, who you got in the draft? Who do you like? What are you doing? Like, it's just something you wouldn't predict. I mean, I remember when the draft started this year, we were on like the third pick and he was out talking to an intern, right? And I was just like, who are you? Like, and then I think he really focuses on like team dynamics and like how different players, even though it might not seem this way, bring different things to the team that most people don't understand. And that's from being a coach and being a player and being, you know, and playing with, I don't know, was it 6 or 9 first ballot Hall of Famers, right? There's a team dynamic that he sees. And then he's also not afraid of betting on people or doing things that are unpopular. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest attributes that he has, is he will do what he believes is right, regardless of anything else. And that's pretty rare in today's
world. I'm looking over your shoulder and it says, tune out the noise and play the long game.
There's no noise in his head. There's no noise in his head.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think when it comes to starting off and building out like a culture, to have him and then selecting Will Hardy as our head coach, who was the youngest coach in the league when we selected him, and Jay-Z and Dwayne and our ownership, like, it's actually like perfect. And so, but more than that, for me, is just one of my good friends, and to be able to go and work with him every day is just like, just right. It feels fun. Like, we were talking about brain typing this morning before.
I actually have a brain typing question that I'll get to in a second on it. Negotiating wise, entering in those conversations, and no trade specifically, but like this, you have 29 other governors with you, right? And you need to maintain relationships with all these people, and you need to build trust with them. But at the same time, you're, you know, bartering. Is there anything to that that you've seen that's particularly interesting?
Yeah. So it's a closed market.
Yeah.
Right. So whoever you run up against, you're going to have to run up against all the time. And actually, people are way more friendly than the media comes out to make them believe. Like, we did a trade with Minnesota. Well, we talk to Minnesota all the time. Like, these are relationships. I think, Cleveland, you know, called this year, was like, hey, like, I don't know what the number is, but like, I think the Jazz and Cleveland have done a trade at some level, like 4 out of the last few years, like no matter what it was, even big or little. But, you know, you have to have those relationships and be connected with everyone, and different trades are made or done for different reasons, right? Sometimes a team just doesn't believe that they have what it takes to get over that next hump. They're close. And by the way, maybe even get to that point where they're right below that moment, they've had to sacrifice. So if they were going to go even more in, it's like literally almost you're setting the franchise back without a higher than 5% chance of winning the whole thing. You kind of got to take a look at it. And that's a situation that we found ourselves in, and that other people around the league, you can go around the league and be like, whoa, these people are on a journey. They were supposed to go do something. Their players are starting to get into higher contracts. The financials are starting to, it's starting to get up there, and they're not going to win it, or they don't have a good chance of winning it. Then you start seeing moves being made, and you know, you've also got to get lucky. I mean, if someone, you know, we were getting ready to host the All-Star game, and what you probably don't want to do is come in and move two All-Stars when you're hosting it the next year. I don't think anyone had Lauri Markkanen starting the All-Star game on their bingo card, right? And but I know Danny and Jay-Z, they loved Lauri, and, you know, we had seen him play in Euro hoops, and like there was something there if he could be a more focused player in the offense.
One of the other things you've done since taking over is the you got rid of the RCN deal and you've gone direct to consumer.
Yeah, the RCN.
Your RSN, sorry, not RCN. What were the inputs into that and how you sort of, because it's you and the Suns, I think, that have the similar.
They're all different, but they're look, the RSN model and cable and media all together is like pretty disruptive right now. Like it's being disrupted in a bunch of different ways. But the reason why it's coming up now is because most of these contracts, I mean, we were on a 10-year contract. So if you actually think about when this contract was signed, it was signed in an era that isn't like the same. I mean, this is like Netflix DVD days, like all of these different things. And what we would do is we would basically take all of our media rights, we would hand them over to a third party. They would give us a check and then just go. And we didn't have input on anything else. That was it. We were just basically franchising those out. And the problem is I come from a world of experience and customer experience. And we have the fastest growing state. We have the youngest state in Utah. And we were showing our games to about 1.2 of the 3.4 million people live in the state, let alone showing games to the folks in Idaho and Wyoming, which are right here. And so, great, we were getting a guaranteed check, but we actually weren't building our brand. It was the number one thing I would hear from fans is like, we can't watch the games. And, you know, our players, our coach, Danny, ownership, like we work way too hard to not let the product be out. And so what we said was we're going to basically become free agents. We're not going to sign a media deal. We're going to work on a deal that's over the air. So we go to 3.2 million people. We're actually going to sign a deal for streaming. So anyone who wants to consume the media in a streaming environment can do that. We're actually going to expand our market and go into the neighboring states. And so we're going to ink that deal. And so we think we can go from like essentially showing games to 1.2 million people to maybe 4 or 5 million. And that'll be done overnight, basically. And so that's a really unique model, but I also think it positions us for where media is going. We don't know where it's going to be in the next 4 or 5 years. But this idea that you enter into these long-term relationships where you don't control your own destiny and you don't control the end product, we don't want to be a part of that. No matter how much that check is, it's not as big as us building out the brand the
right
way.
And is that the trade? I mean, it sounds so logical to me. Hey, why? Of course you would do this the way you're talking about it. But is it really the cash flow cycle?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you're talking, I mean.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds and plus.
But in our situation, we've had, I think there's a couple teams I've seen that have a little bit of a dislocation in their market versus that check size. Okay. So, if I were to look at, I don't want to get too much into teams business, but there are some teams that their check size is so big, they could never do it.
Yeah.
Like the gap is too, we have had such a fast growing market in those 10 years that we're going to take a hit, but we think because of that market size increase being the fastest growing state that we can get back there eventually.
The old on-prem to SaaS transition.
Yeah, yeah. It's 100. I mean, this is exactly what it is. And you're going after eyeballs now.
Now being, so you have 29 other people that you interact with fairly regularly, right? Plus Adam, plus whatever, all the other people, Adam, like he's my friend. Are there things within the league that you've like found as your own passion projects within the organization itself beyond making the Jazz product as good as it can be? Or are you still sort of getting your sea legs in the leagues?
No, I mean, it takes a little while. I think I've been pretty tech focused. Like I think, you know, historically in the league, when we're the youngest group, definitely one that's actually operating or has been operating in tech still, where, you know, I think one of the things Adam told me when I came in was, hey, like whatever you have learned, don't check it at the door. Bring that to the NBA. We want that, which is kind of different than what you would think. Instead of going in and learning that, it's like, no. We want you in here bringing everything from Qualtrics and what it is. So I think the experience side has been something that we love. Like if you actually think about what Qualtrics does is we're powering the customer, the fan, the employee experience of the world, you know, like 50 different airlines, whether you fly on Delta or everything. It's like, it's always Qualtrics. We're trying to help them through not only what happened on their current experience they're providing, but where they want to go next. And so there's a lot of that within the NBA. So how does that translate? You know, I just joined the media committee, right? On, you know, we're coming into a next big media deal, which I think is a really pivotal moment in the league on like how that goes. And so
it will either go very well or very poorly.
Yeah.
And we'll see how it, I mean, I'm sure it'll be good.
Yeah, it'll be good. But I think like how this is done is super, super interesting. And there's a great group of people and I'm excited to go and contribute at that level. I think what we've done on, using the NBA platform, I think we hosted All-Star differently. I mean, it really felt like we activated the entire city and state for the All-Star, which was what we wanted to do. And I think everyone who came felt that this last year. I believe, you know, we just launched a clothing line, right? We launched our own clothing line called Counterpoint.
The NBA did.
No, the Jazz did, right? I'm just joined the social justice committee for the NBA and how we're going to use the NBA to make community impact in many different areas. And I think that came from our work with Five for the Fight, the jersey patch. And, you know, we know this in tech worlds that the platform of tech or a business is the best way to make change. And when we sold Qualtrics, one of my biggest fears was, wait, we have this massive engine to actually do good. And it's way better than any individual, no matter how much money they have to do good. You'd rather have an engine that could continue to do good because you have so many more resources, not just money, but help. And the NBA is another level of that platform. And so we've seen this idea. We sponsored the jersey patch, and this is the last year that we're doing the jersey patch, but we raised $50 million for cancer research. And now we're building out another campaign with the NBA for cancer research.
And we, by the way, so Five for the Fight is...
Yeah, Five for the Fight. Yeah.
When you went to your board at Qualtrics and said, hey, by the way, we're going to do this nonprofit thing that was super expensive. And maybe tell what that is for people.
Yeah,
who don't
know. So when the jersey patch came out, we put Five for the Fight on the jersey.
Paid for by Qualtrics
and donated and not put Qualtrics there, which is the first time in sports. And I mean, Donovan Mitchell wins a slam dunk contest and you're seeing Five for the Fight instead of Qualtrics. I'm just like, this one is amazing, but it's also, it hurts. And that's kind of when you want to be. You want to be in a spot where it's like, it hurts, especially with enterprise software where brand lift is the hardest thing to drive.
Totally.
It's so hard to drive.
And what?
Yeah, it's so hard to drive brand lift in enterprise software, right? And so it was a perfect thing, but it's been such a cool thing for the company.
And it's for cancer research.
Yeah, it's cancer research. And we said, we're going to raise, you know, in 5 years, we're going to raise $50 million. And we raised $50 million for cancer research. And it all started by using that platform of the NBA. Now, we're just mixing up the campaigns. So someone else will grab the jersey patch, but we're putting a bell and we're doing cancer stuff all throughout the arena. At the All-Star game, the celebrity All-Star game, the beneficiary was Five for the Fight. Like, we would have never dreamed of. Who would have known that would have been, you know, a thing? Like I was shooting three pointers with Dwayne Wade to go and like every bucket counted for five for the fight. Like, that's insane.
You referenced earlier brain typing, and productivity is one of the things I'm curious about. So one of the things I think you said was it's not actually about being productive 100% of the day, but instead getting the most out of your day. How do you think about that? And how do you sort of orient your day from a productivity standpoint?
So productivity over time is tricky. Like, some people are like, I've done the same thing for 20 years. This is how I do it. I'm not that person. Like, I want to switch it up. I will switch it up days. I will switch it up weeks. I'm always trying to introspect. How am I feeling? How am I feeling? Because productivity is a feeling. There's definitely a measurable outcome, but I think it's as much also an internal feeling. If we just assume we all work hard, like how is it that we're getting through everything, and how do we feel like we're getting through it? Like, I want to feel good about my work. And for me to do that, not only do I need to do it, I need to do it well by the way that it's measured, but I don't always feel the same way. So over the years, there's a lot that I did. I had an admin who was a statistician who would go back through and like measure every hour I spent at the end of a quarter and give it to me to let me know, like, okay. And we'd sit there, turn the paper over and be like, okay, how much time do you spend on all of these categories? And I was always way off. So our minds don't really understand the productivity the way that we think we do. And so one of the things that I begin to tell people is like, okay, first of all, everyone needs to feel like they're an individual contributor. One of the problems you get into, and I'm sure a lot of people in your pod are CEOs and leaders and executives, like, you can't sit up and operate as this high-paid router, just taking things and routing them.
HR stuff will wear you down eventually.
Yeah, it just, like, that's not going to make you feel better or be able to be better for the rest of the company. And so in my case, I found myself in that position a lot. And so what I would do is, like, I would wake up in the morning, and instead of just going right in the office, I'd go have breakfast by myself. And that was my individual contributor time. I would literally sit there, my music in, my headphones, and I would get some wins before I went and got into the office. Because then it's like, all right, bring it. Come on. I'm ready for it. As opposed to getting into the office, everything's coming, and my wife and I call them zingers. Like, we get zingers, like, hey, how's your day going? I got like five zingers this morning. And we all know what those are, because it's just like, ugh. Like, you want to get some momentum before that happens. Mornings are everything for me. But I think right now, you know, I'm trying to find my new way to be productive when I've got my hands on a lot of things. How does that work? Physical space is really important. Like, where I'm at is really important for me to be productive. I'm incredibly productive on airplanes. It's weird. Like, I will actually think through that and use that time as like some of my favorite time. Like, I love airplane time. I'll write, I'll email, I'll get caught up. Like, that's it. And so just understanding those moments, and then understanding also that, and this is an MBA thing as well, is this is part of the reason why, as we think about the future of work and where we're working from and working in person and working remote, team productivity is what we're measured on. There's no individual winners if the team is losing. And I think that's been a little bit lost in this idea of tech, is so many people saying, well, personally, I am more productive at home. I don't care. The other part of your job that maybe the group hasn't told you about is that you're supposed to share your information with the team members. And you're supposed to be an instrumental part in helping them win. And I've watched too many people over the last 4 or 5 years saying, hey, I'm winning personally, but the team is not winning. And by the way, it also goes the other way. If the team is winning, are you winning personally? And we know that that relationship is always happening. hey, the company's winning, but what's in it for me? Well, it's got to be the other way around as well. And that dynamic is really important. And so I believe that, you know, I know at Qualtrics when we were, and this is a hot topic, but when we were remote, it was super hard to get the team to win.
And everyone probably, or most of the company probably felt they were more productive.
100%.
Right, at home, because like, you're not getting interrupted.
But,
right.
But if we were looking at what our personal productivity would do for a company like ours in 2004, no one would have thought by adding up all their personal productivity that we would be where we were in 2010. But something magic happened when we got together. We not only like 1x, we like 3 or 4 or 5x and had breakthroughs. And trying to dissect and pull that apart and understanding which pieces and where, I don't know. I'm not saying that everyone needs to be in office all the time. But I'm saying is what matters is the team wins. If a company can get there where the team's winning, but that for me is everything. I don't care if one of our players has a 70-point night or a 50-point night if the team loses.
Where do Qualtrics land on the, what's the current policy?
I mean, it's shifting. We're trying to get everyone back into the office, depending on location and role and function. There are some functions where we don't think they need to be back, but where I'm much more interested is saying, hey, what about the other part of everyone's job and how well have we passed on this tribal knowledge that we have as an organization down? And that's where it doesn't show up in personal productivity because you don't understand how many people are watching you and watching what you do and you're setting the tone for an organization. But if you've got 2,500 people who joined the company since everyone's been remote, it's super, super difficult.
Now, you weren't officially the CEO until the Sequoia and Excel round, is that right? And so it was just you, Jarrett.
Yeah, we called it like the team of four.
Who was the fourth?
My father and then Stuart Orgel.
And so it was the four of you. And then Sequoia said, hey, someone needs to be a CEO. And Jarrett said, well, it's not me. You guys kind of did this. And you were the.
Yeah, I remember sitting in front of Leone, Moritz, and Schreier and Sequoia's office. And they looked over and said, hey, we're going to write the check, but one of you needs to be a CEO. And it was just awkward silence. Because Jarrett had just moved back from Google a couple years earlier. And he was running Google China. And he's like, okay, wait, I'm not moving back to Utah for a young startup and working for my younger brother. Like, that's not in the cards. What have you done? Like, look what I've done.
But he's like, also like, I don't want to be the media facing.
And then he stood up and like, it was awkward silence. It was like, it felt like forever. And all of a sudden he stood up and he's like, it's him. He's the CEO. And I was like, what? He's like, I don't do media. And that was it. That was his whole rationale.
And so one of the things you said though, I know it was, it was a growing experience like being a CEO is for anyone, I'm sure. But that what you benefited most from was being a fast learner over the mm-hmm. experience itself. What was stepping into the CEO role? I guess, did anything actually change that day when Jarrett said it's him? And then what was the development process of being a fast learner?
Well, I think Jarrett, I mean, he's just such a unique individual, but he definitely made it his mission to prepare me. And that's a pretty amazing thing to do. Like his whole mission was to basically mentor me. And I think he did that for 10 years, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. He knew where my blind spots were. And then he augmented his own growth to augment me. So someone once asked, like, what are you good at or what is Jarrett good at? And he's like, I'm basically good at everything. Ryan's not. And that's why I think Qualtrics work. That being said, the CEO or any executive on a high trajectory needs to be the fastest learner in the building. And like when you think you're dead set on something, it's a hard balance. It's like, how do you have this incredible confidence and fear, but at the same time to be able to lead and do things? But at the exact same time, you're able to admit when you're wrong and like move on and know when to take back.
We were talking about this a little bit before we started taping, but there's a visualization exercise Bill Gates and Paul Allen, I think, yep, did in the early days of Microsoft, about where they would think about what the company would be in the distant future and build towards that, I guess. I've heard you reference it. Is that a strategy exercise in your mind, a leadership exercise? Why have you referenced that? Like, how has that impacted you?
I think just going through enough. And so first of all, I do know of this. Going through enough planning exercises at the beginning of the year, I think a lot of times we write something down or we get a group together and we say, hey, you know, championship on three, but there's actually no way we're going to get there.
That's right? An output.
It's an output, and it makes everyone feel good in the moment. But I just like to start with the end in mind on a lot of things. And it actually, you know, it's this concept of almost like, let's do the pre-mortem instead of the post-mortem. Like, let's go through and actually go through the pain to say, okay, let's take our business in 2026. You know, if you're a company and you work in SaaS and you're saying, hey, look, we've got, you know, $100 million deals right now and you're growing at 40%, you've got to ask yourself, okay, in 4 years, how many $1 million deals are you going to have? Oh, wow. Like, you actually got to be doing that every month or every quarter. Like, people won't go through that exercise, but it actually provides a roadmap for you without even creating one. You know that when you're in the moment and you've got to make a decision that's going to impact deal size or talent, that you know what you're solving for already. And so, you know, we'll often, you know, whether it's product or whether it's something, or just like, okay, bring me your press release. Let's walk through your press release at the end of the year, end of the quarter, the end of 90 days. You really like this product. We're shipping it. I want to release it. I want you to write the press release, and I want you to write like what it is. And I've even used this exercise when we were acquiring a company. I remember we acquired a stats company out of Y Combinator called Stats IQ. And it was like, oh, we do stats. And it's like, okay, you do stats in the cloud. And it's like, yeah. And I was like, all right, let's go down and sit down and write this press release. And we wrote this press release, and it was like, this is the first ever low code, no code stats cloud platform in the world. And it's now hooked onto Qualtrics. So basically every single person is going to be able to become a statistician by using Qualtrics and taking their data, and we've completely democratized it. And it's like, well, no, we don't do that. I was like, well, no, that's exactly what we're doing. It took a minute, but then that's exactly what we ended up doing with this product. Because that became the vision just by simply going through that exercise. Having to actually talk through it, having to say, no, we're not going to do that, or yeah, we're going to do.
So it's not as much, it's kind of neither strategy nor leadership. It's a forcing function of an exercise of the tactics that will actualize to an outcome in some way. It's sort of like the score will take care of itself or whatever it is. Like, let's focus on the inputs of this as well as the long-term vision.
Yeah, it's a little bit like if you were comparing to basketball, hey, if we make 5 3-pointers and we get 70% of the rebounds, we're going to win no matter what. And so what you're doing is you're looking at a moment that you're putting down and memorializing. And then you're looking back at the team, the product, or the boat, and you're like, yeah, okay, I see that. Or, yeah, that's what we're doing. That's going to work. And so you're able to course correct based on that outcome. And I think we do it in life. I've shared this story a bunch. Like, so many people I know in life feel like they're doing a bad job at everything. It's a common thing you hear. I'm doing a bad job as a parent. I'm doing a bad job as a husband or a wife or whatever it is. I'm doing a bad job as a leader. And then the question is like, okay, let's just take this week. What would that moment be on Saturday night where you would feel like you did an amazing job? And most people can't articulate it. I was like, so you're going to feel bad about yourself all the time, but you can't articulate what's going to make you feel like you killed it this week? Like, what is it? well, let's say his husband, like with Ash, it'd be like, okay, if I like took Ash to lunch one day this week, I got her flowers and I did something else nice that no one was expecting, I'd actually feel like I was a pretty good husband and I was clean this week. I like cleaned the house or whatever. Like I would feel like I did some. And I'm like, whoa, I could do all that by Tuesday.
Yeah.
If I thought through it. And then like the kids the same way, like individualizing it. And that's the difference besides waking up with no plan of how you're going to get something done. And so in a way, you're child-proofing or you're creating a framework. It's a framework to think about things through and actually think about big things. So what seems like moonshots actually become just what you do.
I want to back up to the Qualtrics story a little bit here. So you had a 1.9 GPA at high school. You didn't take the SATs, and then you only graduated so that you could go on a trip to South Korea with your with your friends. Can you tell me a little bit about like Ryan Smith up to 18 years old?
It wasn't a good picture. I don't know why. Like I was pretty athletic. I worked at a golf course when I was 14. My parents split up when I was 14. I kind of just took that moment and just didn't really care. You know, world was rocked a little bit and, you know, you kind of take these moments and you kind of get back on the horse. And it was just a weird time. I went as a teenager and I just didn't care about a whole lot. And, dropped out of high school as a sophomore and like literally dropped out, didn't go to school. I played golf during the day and didn't have a lot of supervision to tell me or authority that could tell me what to do. And then, you know, my friends, I actually started working at one of the early tech companies that sold to Excite at Home. And someone was looking out for me and just said, hey, you're up to no, come over here.
And it was when you were like 16.
And I was like 16. It was my uncle. And he gave me a job. And I was with all these tech guys. And two of them had just gotten back from Seoul, Korea, where they were teaching English. And I was like, well, I'm going to teach English. And I went to my dad and said, I'm going to Seoul, Korea. And he said, well, you got to graduate high school. And so like in 3 months, I just threw it all. I didn't care about the GPA. I didn't care about anything. And then went over to Seoul, Korea.
You showed up and the job wasn't there.
Job wasn't there. My friends came home. I called my dad and said, hey, this isn't working out. Go to the airport for an international ticket. And he's like, no. Like,
because your friend's dads bought the tickets.
They bought
home.
The tickets. And my dad's like, no. I'm like, you got a place to sleep? Good. Go sort this out.
And you didn't really have a place to sleep.
No.
Right?
And his whole idea was like, look, you're at rock bottom here. There's a chance you might learn something if you can hang out there. And, you know, I ended up coming home from Korea a year later.
And so what do you, in that moment, your dad says, figure it out. And there's no job. And so you go and find a job.
I had a contact of one individual and I went and just like literally called his place all the time, went and found him. It was life or death. And, you know, over that year, I had to learn about myself. I had to learn, first of all, are my ideas good? Do I know how to work? All the things that probably I didn't feel like I was. And then I got some wins and I started making some money and I started like building a business and just having confidence that like, okay, there's this connection between what's in my brain and what's in my heart and my feet. I can go do something. And I think it kind of paved the way for the rest of my life. And it was that moment where it was like, all right, you're going to have to go create something.
In a quite literal sense, I mean, I've heard you talk about it, but like you would sleep at the school and then make up your bed and then the kids would come in and you would teach. And then that was like your rotation
No one knew that I was like living on the couch. Like it would be one of those things where you find the employee sleeping in the hallway or the stairwell, like I had no one knew.
it's quite literally like a movie scene, it feels like. And then from there, so you establish like more regimen and sort of get back on track for that. And then did you go straight from there to Mexico?
Yeah, I decided, you know, it was interesting. I moved in with, I actually ended up moving in with four guys who had served LDS missions in Korea. And I was like, wait, like this world's different. Because they weren't out partying all the time. They were super buttoned up. They spoke the language, but they were fun. They were like hilarious.
And yeah, I thought there were only two.
I thought there was only two paths. I was like, wait a minute. How can you be like someone who is contagious that you want to hang out with all the time, but you're not out partying? Like that didn't compute to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to be like them. Like, I actually want to be like them. And I started getting into it and I decided I wanted to go on a mission, and I hadn't really been on that path at all. And I came home and you kind of submit your papers where you don't know, you go to one of 300 countries, you pay for it. So I'd saved enough money in Korea. Not only did I want to go, I had saved all the money, and I knew my brothers wouldn't believe me that I was going to do this. So I remember walking in and saying, hey, I'm going on a mission and here's the money to pay for it. And they were like, well, he's serious. There's the money. Right. And I get called, you get a letter, and I get called to Mexico City. And so like, here I am going, whoa, I was just in like the fifth largest city in the world. Now I'm the number one largest city in the world. And by the time I got to Mexico that summer, I was like, I can handle it. I was like, okay, I'm built for this. And then it was just like, it was like this 3.5 year period where it was almost a little bit like, hey, listen, you screw up. Like, there's a bigger plan for you. I know you can't see it, but there's a bigger plan. And almost like someone was grabbing me saying, hey, like, you're not going down that road. Like, this is where you're supposed to be. And went on my mission, came back from my mission, decided I want to go to school. Walked. I was like, wait, like, I've only got a 1.9 GPA. I haven't taken the ACT or any of this stuff. Registered at a community college. Got a 4.0, transferred up to BYU, got into BYU, which is incredibly difficult. End up getting into the business school, end up starting Qualtrics, end up meeting my wife, and kind of the rest is history. And so, like, for me, there's like two lives of Ryan Smith. There's like the prior life or the before life, and then like the life where it's like, no, we're going to go do something. It's pretty incredible when you kind of think back and look at it that way.
I've heard you say that some of the lessons or a bunch of the lessons you've learned on the mission, and maybe it's mission in South Korea, you use throughout your life as a leader or executive.
Yeah, for sure.
What were some of the interesting things that came out of that are applicable to leadership?
The one I try to teach my kids is like walking down the street every day in Mexico City. And this is not like, I mean, I had the worst places. I was the place where the locals don't go. And this is every day. I lived there. I lived right by the airport. I lived all over down there. Like, one of them is just awareness around you. I mean, like, head on a swivel. And like, I think that's something that you can't really teach. So that's one that I've always was kind of top of mind. The other thing is, you know, when you're on a mission, you're working towards a singular goal and focus. And there's incredible power of focus. You're not doing anything else. And that was such a luxury to feel the level of focus that you could actually get when you actually kind of tune out noise, right? As we're looking back.
Yeah.
Right? And then I think relationships matter. Like, if I look at the relationships of the people who I still work with, who, you know, I work with one of the individuals who changed my life in Seoul, Korea. Stuart Orgel was one of our co-founders who was a mission companion. Like that matters. And then I also think that like doing it your way, like this was not the way people thought I would go. People, you know, I decided at that point, like I'm never going back to that old Ryan. And like everyone, everywhere I've been in my professional career has been like accepting of who I am today and what I stand for and what I believe. And like, people don't see that all the time. They think that it's going to be hard. I don't drink. I don't do certain things. Like, like, it's never been a problem. It's actually been an advantage. And so I think that, like, I think it's inspirational for people to say, hey, like, every one of us is a unique soul and a unique individual. And, like, you can do it your way and it can work out. And so I think that's a lesson that I'm, like, trying to tell my kids as well, is, like, look, all of you, and I have five kids, they all come in different packages. Mm-hmm. Even though mom and dad are, like, you know, thinking that they're all going to be kind of this similar spinoff of us, they're not. And so how do you unlock the kind of creative magic that each one of them has and kind of let them believe that they can go do that? Or for me, like, I don't know that my kids are ever going to have that career experience. Like, that was pretty unique and pretty much saved my life.
So now you're at BYU, you have an internship in Southern California, you get a call, dad has cancer, you come home. And that was actually kind of the genesis of Qualtrics, sort of came out of that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I just, in like post-Korea mission fashion, emailed a bunch of people in the business school who were alumni at BYU at the Marriott School and said, hey, I'm going to be in California. Do you have a job? And someone emailed me. This is right. I mean, this is like 2001, right? Kind of not a time for a startup. And someone said, like, hey, I'm about ready to hire someone. I'm at HP. That was a stable job then. Everyone had gone through that tech boom, and then everyone rushed back to brick and mortar and didn't want to go to do with anything with tech because everyone got boomed or got burned. And so I was down there. I was in the middle of an internship. It was going great. I was living in Huntington Beach, driving up to like Long Beach area. And my dad called, and I just got that call that it's like, what do you do? He's like, I just want to tell you personally, like, I got some really bad news. This is happening. You know, I don't have much longer. No one knows. And I'm trying to figure it out. The family's devastated. And I had become pretty close with my dad. Like, I think that's one thing that, you know, post Korea, he's just a gifted human who was able to do incredibly hard things for me, but he knew me. He knew how to communicate with me. Where like ages 14, 18, one of those things where like the older I got, the wiser you got.
Yeah. Amazing how much he learned in that. Yeah.
Yeah. He really grew.
Yeah.
And then like, he just had his own way. Like, he'd never do anything for me, but he'd always be there for me. And so I was just like, no, I got to go be there for him. Like, you've totally changed my life. Like, I am going to be there for you. And I was there, and he'd go do his radiation treatments. And then like, he'd come home and was floored. I was like, we can't do this. Like, let's go do something. You know, I had been working in tech. He had this idea. He had been working on it. And we just said, like, this is what we're going to go do. But he had throat cancer, and, you know, couldn't speak. And Qualtrics, when it started, was incredibly sophisticated. I mean, this was an academic product, and the people on the other side were PhD researchers who were some of the best and brightest in the world. I didn't know anything about them. And so we really had to wing it. We really had to say, hey, like, I mean, he was writing stuff down while I'm on calls with like, you know, professors from UNC. I'll never forget, like, John Lynch at Duke, who runs, you know, Dan Ariely, all those people learned under him. He's the godfather of research. And like, I'm on the phone with him trying to guess what he's going to do or the problems he's got in this little software app that we've created.
Cause your dad was a professor, I guess.
He was a professor, and we were in such a niche group. And that's when I decided, like, hey, dad, like, if you can be that side, like, I'm really good at the business side, I can grow this thing. Like, and then Stu joined, and like, we got up and we got it going. And
was your dad coding it?
He was helping code it, but it was very much the methodology around it, because at the time, the integrity of the process of research online. Research online was not a widely accepted practice. Hmm. I mean, in fact, all the journals would say it wasn't valid because of sample sizing and everything else. And it wasn't in person. And that's crazy today. But those were literally the obstacles we would deal with. And so we had to have a lot of, you know, blessing from academics who had published in aid journals to say, hey, actually, what people say online is actually true at some level. And you can test it. You could actually publish from it. And so getting all these people to publish, and then from there, wanting to be able to take that to corporations, like, there was still a lot of skepticism. And this was back when you wouldn't enter your credit card online.
Yeah.
You remember those days?
Totally.
So going through all of that was interesting.
So you got it going, and Northwestern signed up and UNC signed up, and you got some schools using it, but your dad was kind of like, this isn't a real thing. You go get another job. And so then you were at Ford.
Yeah. Like Ford was recruiting. They were taking one or two students from BYU, and like I got the job, and then they wanted me to go to Dearborn. And I was like, I want to do Qualtrics. And my dad's like, no, like you can't do Qualtrics. So I convinced him to let me go to Denver. My job was to work in brand marketing and launch the F-150 for the West, the new body style. So I had all the states in the West. And I remember working there. And then on my lunch break, I was still like closing deals. And I closed Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. And I closed the deal for about as much as they would pay me at Ford for the year. And I remember calling my dad, and I was like, are we doing this? Like, I'm like literally working in the mornings, at lunch, and at night. If I went full time, like there's something there, but I was in school as well. And so it was complicated, but we got to the right thing. And I think, I had to fight for it. And I also learned a ton at Ford. I learned that, like, hey, you can market. You're good. Like, you understand the brand side. You have good ideas. And, you know, especially with multi-million-dollar ad agencies coming in and pitching how you're going to launch this. And all of that mattered.
You touched on expanding out of corporate. I know that wasn't easy, or getting out of the academic world. I would say that's probably not something we encourage our companies to do, to start in academia and then expand to corporate. Your first 7 enterprise customers left, I think. I don't know if Royal Caribbean was one of them, but first 2 sales reps wanted to quit. How did you go about expanding from the academic market to the corporate market? And was that the vision that, like, okay, if this is going to be big, we need to get these other people?
I mean, this was probably like part of the press release thesis of like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go after academia because we're already here and we can pay the bills that way. But the real pitch is like, how do we get them to tell corporations, because academics have no money, and, you know, we didn't have money for marketing. So we needed to use, we always viewed the academic as like, hey, if we treat academics different than everyone else, they'll be great marketing for us. And every company wants to break into that world. This is very much like back in the day, it was like, oh, this is like Apple and the Apple One and Apple Two. And you learn through academia, this is like LexisNexis. This is like, people have done this model. Everyone wants to do that. There's not a product out there that's like, hey, we don't want the market.
Because you start and then they graduate, and Esri did it famously with like maps, right? And like now it's the standard in the software industry.
Yeah, it happens there, but it's a horrible, you're never getting investment.
You can't monetize it.
You can't monetize it. And so we were just stuck there. And then a couple things happened. Number one is students started graduating. Kellogg made it a mandatory class. We started doing their field study projects for their MBA students. And I specifically remember calling every single MBA student who did a field study for a third party and saying, hey, could you make the connection so that we could go and sell? I mean, it was grassroots. Like, this wasn't, we didn't have a team.
This is
me on the phone waking up every morning and saying, hey, who are we calling? Stu's doing the same thing and servicing up. Like, this is how we're doing it.
So just to be clear, academic, they did a field study at Northwestern for MBA. And
yeah.
You're like, hey, can you put me in touch with your contact at Jeff?
100%. I specifically remember someone from doing a research study on Qualtrics from Heineken. And it went well. And it's the first time they've ever done anything like it. And me saying, all right, give me your contact. Like, let's go. And they end up buying a $50,000 license. And so this was how we were going to go do it. And then it was our job to land them and kind of educate, because we were doing something new for these companies. And the idea was, is like, look, research isn't this outsourced thing. It's not a part. You can actually predict the future. And like, you can be right. And that was our whole pitch. 2007, 8, 9 happened, where marketing departments pretty much went away. I mean, you know, we have a lot of volatility in the macro environment right now. And you hear every earnings call, well, the macro environment, unless you're in video. But like, if you look at that world, that's interesting, but actually companies are still intact. Back then, companies were not intact for us. And so, but what did happen is everyone went back to universities. Universities had more money than ever. And so we got a fresh start and we kept rolling. And the whole time we were bootstrapped. You know, if we didn't make it, we didn't eat it.
And did some of the brands move stuff in-house that was otherwise done by agencies?
100%. And so during the pandemic, my pitch was cheaper, faster, better. You can do more and there's not a better time for you to do this than right now. Like, you have to understand what the market's going to react, because you used to be able to have a certain amount of inefficiency in your budgets and in your teams. You're actually being asked to run in a deficit right now and you have no margin for error. We can help you be right. If you're going to launch a commercial, let's test it. If you're going to do this, let's test it. You know, your websites, let's make sure that Qualtrics is on every part of your websites. Your employee base, let's make sure that people are all right. And that was a model that we kind of built out.
I heard you say that one competitor, I don't know if this is true, but raised more money, had a better product and lower prices in the early days, which seems like a recipe that's hard to beat. I don't know if you're just being overly humble about that, but it was a competitive. There were other players, better funded, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, we had one competitor in 2005 and 6. I remember that it raised $40 million, which was a lot at the time.
Yeah, you had zero.
Yeah, we had zero. They were on the front page of every magazine, and they had a better product and it was cheaper.
How did you out-execute these? Like, was there, I mean, the academic thing probably helped.
So I think we did out-execute them, but I also think that they didn't get out of their own way. And this is the problem. You know, I've seen over a 22-year period, it's like, I knew that they were raising money and they were just kind of blowing through it. And we literally had to tune out the noise and play the long game. And sure enough, they self-sabotaged because their cap table was so screwed.
Is Qualtrics a better business because of those constraints that you bootstrapped and therefore you had to value the money?
100%. And I don't think it's because of the money. I mean, although the money is the
forcing function.
Forcing function there. But the symptom or what comes out of it is you actually have to be innovative as a company. If my number one question is when I sit on boards or I'm in board meetings, like, okay, if we handed you another $20 million, what would change? And the answer is normally not a whole lot. Because they've got to be forced, and out of necessity, you think of how you're going to go do something. You're not calling Heineken through a reference of a field study project if you've got a bunch of cash in the bank. You're just not. But when that's your only thing, you see signals that are different for opportunity when you're completely resourceful.
You get an offer in 2012 to sell for $500 million, and it's totally bootstrapped, and you guys were in a fortuitous position with that. Why not sell? What were the inputs that you were thinking about at that?
I mean, everyone told us to. I mean,
who was everyone at that?
Everyone I talked to in the state of Utah, everyone that was here. I had one advisor who became the chairman of the board. He's the only one that said, don't sell. And he sat me and my brother, my dad. My brother, my dad looked at me and said, Ryan, this is your decision. And he jumps in and says, Ryan, as far as I can see, if you and Jared can get along, then I think you guys will let this run. And then...
And you're in your early 30s?
Yeah, early 30s. And that's a lot. We hadn't given out equity. We owned the whole company. And, you know, I got in the car with my wife and we said, we got to drive. So we like scheduled like a 3-day weekend. We didn't get more than a half hour. She was like, I don't know why you'd sell. Like, what are you going to do?
I don't want you around.
Yeah, I don't want you around. like, what are you going to do? And then, you know, I went back to that individual after we turned the money down. And I said, why were you the only one? Why were you the only one? And he's like, well, who else did you ask? And we went through the whole thing. He's like, had any of them ever been in that situation before? He's like, no. He's like, I was running this at WordPerfect. I was the one that would have to write a couple $100 million check every year as distribution to the founders. I've held that kind of money. I've been in that spot. I knew what happened when you sold and what happened to the company. And I knew what happened when you didn't. So the problem is you asked the wrong people. You asked a bunch of people that you thought were successful, but you didn't ask anyone who had been in that spot before. And I see that so much. That advice is so, and people say, hey, I've talked to all these people. This is what it is. Or like when the company's getting ready to go public and like everyone's freaking out at IPO, but they're not talking to people who've actually ever been through an IPO. And so that was a great lesson that I learned, that if you're going to take advice from people, couch it based on, first of all, have you ever actually been in this situation before? Or one where the stakes are this high? And in that situation, the stakes were high. And I think it was the money was one thing, but also the post, what happened to the company if it's not done right? It's the end of the ride. And I think there's a lot of people who were involved with WordPerfect back in the day and that sell the Novell that were not happy with how that ride ended.
And then at that point, I mean, I assume there's no calculation you can really do that says, oh, if I go for it, it's this versus that. It's a very personal decision at that point that like, hey, I'm going to be good in either of these scenarios. And does it feel like the journey has more legs to it?
Yeah, like I've taught a class for a couple of years called Launch to Liquidity. I used to do it with Jonathan Levav at Stanford. And we'd be in the MBA students and he'd always do these little polls. Like, what would you do if you were Ryan in this situation? And like, they would all vote. And then he'd call out the students, the MBA students, and saying, hey, why would you do this? Why would you do this? Why would you do this? And they were all off. It's all personal. They're like, it's like, why do I want to or not want to? And, you know, it came down to the car ride with my wife.
Yeah.
And none of them had that on their rationale. And like, I think that that's where it's like, they're looking at this case study and MBA exercise, and that's just not reality.
Waiting $100 million versus the path to no, it's actually
the rate of interest return. Yeah. And it's like, what are you talking about?
Your life is pretty much the same until you buy an MBA team. And then it's really good. But up until that point, and what was the advice? So there's, you sat down with Mike Moritz as well, who legendary venture capital Sequoia. And what was he feeling you out at this point?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like,
because Sequoia wasn't an investor then. Ultimately, they were.
We had no venture capital. We were in the process. My brother Jared was adamant, no venture capital. My dad was adamant, no venture capital.
What was that, by the way?
My dad had kind of watched a lot happen in 98 and 99 and, you know, really had an adverse reaction to people who were building $100,000 buildings and redoing the interior but couldn't pay their bills. And he didn't like that model. He didn't like the model we saw with the company raising $40 million. He felt like a model where we were profitable, we were growing, we could dictate our own terms, we were self-reliant, was a model that we had achieved. And every month I was paying my dad a lot of money and the other founders a lot of money. And that was a good model. So why would we take outside capital to go give that up? And you know, you really had to believe that there was a bigger ambition there. And it really came down to, look, we've got this asset and this opportunity that could be something way bigger than anyone thinks that we ever thought. We need more people in the tent. We need the smartest people in the world in the tent. This is why we want venture capital. We want them to be our partners. Look at Duff being in the tent and how value add he is. If we're not going to take the money and sell, we better take something and get some people in the tent because they're now our competition and we got to go. And so then it became, okay, we're bringing the smartest people we can find in the tent. How much is it going to cost them to play with us? And Moritz, I specifically remember at dinner, I'm sitting across the table from the guy who gave Steve Jobs his first money, gave Larry and Sergey the first money, like, and he's going, you know, he basically says, Ryan, like, this is the perfect litmus test for me. Why aren't there more successful companies in Utah? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, there's a bunch of companies that could have been, but we don't talk about them anymore. There may be a little interesting dinner conversation, but they're not relevant. And so you've got a choice in front of you. Do you want to be an interesting dinner conversation, or do you actually want to build something relevant? And I was like, I want to build something relevant, you know? But so we grabbed Sequoia and we grabbed Accel, two best venture firms at that time, and put them together. And did, you know, Jared knew Schreier and I knew Sweeney, and like we did it, and they were both young. And for the next 10 years, we just rocked. And it was like one of the coolest partnerships that I've ever been a part of.
What changed between that moment at 500 million and then SAP at 8 billion? And obviously there's been...
What was the sell difference?
Yeah. Like, what was the big input? Was it just the order of magnitude, the money, and how many people would do well now within the company, and the journey felt more fulfilled? And like, what was that car ride you took with Ashley in 2012 versus the conversation, the napkin at Catalyst's, conference with Bill McDermott?
So first of all, it was the next time someone approached us.
Right.
That's what people don't understand, especially what founders. I mean, if you look at our trajectory, we were 100% grower all the way up to 50% grower, kicking off cash, not consolidated, owning a category. And we had two people approach us in 22 years to acquire us. So I tell all these founders who are building something to go get acquired, like, it's not going to work out the way you think it is. You don't build a company. You better build it to keep it. Because your company looks nothing like ours. And we had no one circling, right? And so, I think a lot of change. Number one is, you know, when we turned down the 500, I specifically remember, and I'll be straight up, this was Dave Goldberg back in the day, incredible human. He was sitting right across the street.
Dave Goldberg, CEO of SurveyMonkey, rest in peace, passed away 5 years ago, probably?
Yeah, five, seven years ago. And he came and said, like, I remember saying, I like sat him down. He came out here and he said, hey, look, we're not going to join forces. We're going to go at it alone. He said, well, I was like, I'm not ready to exit right now. And he said something I'll never forget. He said, you realize you're exiting either way. When you take venture money, you're exiting. You're getting on the rails, on the track. I was like, and then he said, well, how do you think you're going to be able to do this alone? And at the time, I had like walked him through our headquarters. He put on a Qualtrics hat and walked through. And I was like, well, I just got you to put on a Qualtrics hat and walk through our building. I think we're going to do okay. And it was funny, but as I look back, he was 100% right. The second you take on that venture capital, you are getting on a path towards an exit. Whether or not they're pressuring you or not, if you have any decent awareness or care at all, you're going to want to do right by them. I wanted to return the whole fund of Sequoia and Accel for betting on us. We wanted to be able to recruit talent to come into the building that would ultimately be able to say, hey, I was right by going here. We wanted to be able to take the platform global. We wanted to do all these things. Those were all the reasons to go take venture capital. But you've got to line those reasons up with the way you monetize all of that, not only to pay for the growth, but also for the employees and the people that are working on it. And so what we were able to do was say, hey, we're getting ready to go public. We actually were going public. We were on the roadshow. McDermott calls and says, hey, Ryan, like we had been talking. He's like, hey, do you want to be a public CEO? I was like, what kind of question is that? Like, we're on the tape, bro. Like, it's going, like, ticker's out in 3 days. But do you really want to be a public CEO? And I was like, actually, no. Like, he's like, why? And I was like, because you talk to any public CEO, the high mark is it's not that bad. I was like, so the best I know are like, it's not that bad. That's not that lofty of a goal of happiness in that role. But I said, I'm willing to go do it. But never as a kid was I like, oh, I need to go be a public CEO or I'm not fulfilled. Just didn't care about it. And he said, well, I have a proposition for you. How about you come public through us? I'll take you public. And we'll put you at the tip of the SAP spear and all the marketing and everything. We will take you to the world, the largest company in Europe. One of the reasons why you want to go is you want to have this party where everyone can see Qualtrics globally. We'll take you further and better than anyone else. And it's true. You know, the only company on the road, we announced it, $8 billion largest private software acquisition prize of all time. And the whole thing, he did everything he said he was going to go. And then we got in there and he obviously left after a year. And, you know, I think his philosophy was really going after the customer, where they had not been a customer focused organization. It was much more back office, ERP, solutions. And this was more like, hey, we're going to go make a massive play at some of the other customer focused providers, which Salesforce, all these other things. And, we're building out this new category, and that's what he wanted to do. And so I think during the pandemic, everything shifted back to ERP. And, you know, we're not a company. Qualtrics isn't a company just kind of let just chill there. We're in the middle of building out a massive category. And so we decided together, well, I didn't want to leave it. Like, let's go public. And so we took it public, and then right before the IPO, we sat around with Chris Beckstead, myself, and Zig, who we had grown the company a lot with. And I just said, Zig and Chris, like, you guys are going to be the most recruited people here. Everyone's going to want you to go be CEO and president. Why don't I slide over? Zig, you take CEO. Chris, you're president, and I'll be founder. And that's what happened. And then a year and a half into it, you know, we decided that we needed to spin out, I mean, deconcentrate SAP shares, because it's hard when someone owns 70% to even get any float. And, you know, the markets were crazy, the pandemic affected, but the business was awesome. And so we decided to do a little bit of an auction, and Silver Lake, who was an investor, and Egon sitting on the board, ended up winning the bids and came full throttle, writing the biggest check they've ever done. We have a lot of respect for those guys. If you think about Dell and even the work at Twitter and Airbnb and VMware, obviously UFC, Endeavor, Fanatics, and like they don't make that many bets, but they go all in. And this was the biggest check they've ever written. So we're about 3 or 4 weeks from that, where Zig's the CEO, I'm chairman. Like, we're rolling. Pretty cool. So.
Cool.
Four years and like three different transactions. You can't make it up, especially because once we sold SAP, I mean, 30% of our workforce left. They said the ride's over. We're never going to be a chance to be a part of it. Well, how do you know that? They were getting advice from the wrong people. And then it goes public, and then and one of the coolest parts about this is Excel Partners just came in for a lot of money into this new company. And they said, I said, why are you doing this? And they said, well, you're pre-IPO again. We invest in pre-IPO companies. So here we are.
There's going to be fourth?
It's good.
I heard you say that you made every mistake that you could as the CEO, and I'm sure that's a bit of an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. But the product market fit element of like what you guys established, is there anything that you can take away that anyone should internalize about the Qualtrics product market fit in this? And you talked about doing things that don't scale and like bouncing between the Northwestern person to the Heineken person and all that. But as it relates to the product and the insight you all had and how you actually developed and built around it, is there anything that you would point to that we didn't talk about in that?
I think in 2017, we basically completely move the market because we said we're going in a different direction and we did it from a position of strength and we created our own category. The experience management category. That was a hard decision.
Because the category historically would have been...
We had like a survey or an insight platform, but if you actually got into the data, you had hundreds and thousands of people logging in to do something.
Because people would do it for their own employees, they would do it for their customers.
Yeah, and so people would be like, oh, Qualtrics, you're the research platform. Oh, Qualtrics, you're employee platform. Be like, no, we're more than that. You're the customer platform. Well, we're more than that. But we basically laid out a roadmap over the next 6 years coming from that base that this is what we were going to go build and this is how we were going to talk about it. And this is the story in the category. And it was a bet the company move. Absolutely bet the company. Creating a new category of experience because it wasn't one that our customers asked for. They were not asking for it. And it wasn't product market fit. We basically believed in this and then and told the world why experience is the commonality. But we didn't do it blindly. We had a different view of what 10,000 brands at the time were doing on our platform. We could see the problems they were solving. And, you know, it was validated. For example, Royal Caribbean Cruise Line calls me in the middle of the pandemic. They've got no ships going out. They've got one ship stranded with all of their employees on it because of COVID. And they called to renew their license. And actually, great. Why? Like, let's talk for a second. And by the way, I mean, this is a dear to my heart customer because it, like the stories that I've already told. But they said, look, all of our other data that's coming in is pretty useless right now. We need to know how our employees are doing. We need to know, well, what is it that would make our customers feel safe to go cruise again and where they would want to go? Pretty much you're the only ones in the world that can give us that new flow of data. And we were like, okay, great. They got it. And by the way, they're going to put it all on one single platform and, you know, run the analysis of where to go and how to go and customers feeling good. But then they have this other employees that feel safe as well. Serving customers.
Work-life balance. It seems that you don't necessarily believe in that. You believe there's elements of integration of your work and your life. Your wife's dance studio is downstairs.
Down below us?
Yeah, right below us as you walked in, which is very confusing when I came in the wrong door. But your kids are around. And I think they were Qualtrics. People would bring their kids to work and all of that. I see your kids at basketball games and stuff. How do you think about like not work-life balance, but the integration of your work in life? Is that kind of rooted in the fact that it was at the founding? It was you and your dad?
No, no one's ever told me no. So why wouldn't we do it? Right? I think we're all trying our hardest and like I care about that portion of my life. I think a lot of people do. And I think you can do it all. I just truly believe that. You know, tech's a little harder. Like there wasn't as much of a role for like Ash and the kids inside Qualtrics. There wasn't. And in most tech companies, there's not. There's just not. It's not a family really event. And, you know, so how do you make the culture as family friendly as possible? Because we always believe that if the family was on board, then that's really the team. And if you actually look at how it's translated, the MBA is much more, it's actually the first thing that Ash and I have really been able to do together. And that's what's really cool. Way more than tech. And so I think the idea of tech was, hey, we care. And a lot of companies, it's not just a Qualtrics thing. We want people to feel like they're either part of the family or their family's a part of the company as well. And that was it. I mean, right across the street's the 40,000 square foot daycare center, right?
Qualtrics employees.
For Qualtrics employees only. But we did that during the pandemic or right before the pandemic for working mothers, really. We wanted to be able to recruit and to be able to have more, you know, mothers with children be able to go and work in our offices and actually be able to feel like they were taken care of. And it's a combination now between whoever the primary care responsible person is or whoever they're doing. So it's not just females who are there. It's males. It's like, it's however the family setup is, it's at the daycare. But what we've been able to do is set up this environment where people can check in with their family. And what's kind of amazing is my kids don't want me around all the time. Like, but they want to check in with me. I think that's a really cool thing. And by the way, it's like proximity to work's a big thing. And it's something that we've tried to carry over to the NBA as well. Whether it's with our players or people on the road or people who moved to Utah. Just really trying to say, hey, look, this is a little different. This hopefully is something different.
I want to read some things that you said, and I want to get you just to expound on them a little bit, because I took down as particularly interesting thoughts. So I guess original thought is incredibly difficult and incredibly painful. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, like when you think of stuff that you came up with or you invented, it's hard. And it's almost like every good thing you do, there's 20 other people that put off. And like, whenever we see that, and it's stupid stuff. Like, I remember we came up with this amazing hoodie at Qualtrics, and it was designed and sourced overseas. And like, I wanted it because the high neck came up, was like this killer hoodie, and it said Qualtrics on it, and everyone who had one. And then I started seeing like 45 different brands with something just like it. So what do you say? And we came up with like original thoughts hard. Like, and that's it. And it's painful. It's painful to come up with something. But, you know, as a culture, you want to be able to have a culture where original thought is always existent. I always bet on that company with original thought. We had to have original thought in our company because we were resource constrained. You had to be able to think through it. So if someone wants to come and go through a real tour of Qualtrics or even this place, or like, we always try to come up with stuff. And that's what makes it fun.
I think I know where this is coming from, but you said it's sad to see people job hop every year and a half, and that nothing great happens over a short period of time. Is that just 22 years of chopping wood? And
I've been able to see the beginning to the end, and watching people's careers and watching those who actually stayed through the hard parts. And actually what I found is very few people were able to run away from the problem they actually had to solve. My brother Jared used to always tell me, like, when it came to a blind spot or coaching someone or something, is like, hey, they've heard it before. And especially when you're young in your career, I think when you're post 40, it's really hard to change. So when you're young in your career and you've got someone or an organization that's willing to bet on you and is on a high trajectory, then, you know, you should ride that train. That being said, like, a lot of people have thought that, especially in tech, that it's easy and you can just go jump on any company and you're going to catch that next wave. And the problem is like, from what I've seen in tech, is like, I always say that if it looks like a lottery ticket, it's probably not. Because if you actually go to the early days of most of these companies, whether it's us, Atlassian, Slack, they're not what you would say looks like that. It's almost like you need to get in there. And I know that there's reasons why there's false starts and things happen, but I think this culture of not being able to sit through something and actually learn the hard lessons is one that I just, for my own kids, I hope that they don't get that. Like, I had to sit through Seoul, Korea. I'm watching in the NCAA and the transfer portal. Anything, something gets hard, it's like, I'm out. Like, wait, that's not how you're going to be able to grow. And so just because someone offers you more money or a different job, like, I'll never forget my brother when he was at Deep Nishar, who, you know, if you remember him from LinkedIn, sure, and everything, came to him and said, Jared, I want you to go work with Kai-Fu Lee and I want you to go run Google China. And he said, wait a minute, I'm going to go over and live in China. I'm going to live in a hotel in Beijing. And you're not going to pay me as an expert. You're not going to give me more money where I could actually go into another organization here. I could get a promotion and it's guaranteed. Why would I go take that job? And he came to Jared and said, because one day you'll pay me $20 million for the opportunity. And Jared ends up taking the Google job. He ends up doing that and then coming back and coming with me. I'll never forget the meeting I had sitting down at lunch in Palo Alto with Deep. They're telling the story, and then Jared chimes in and says, I would have paid you 60 or something. And how do you get that if you're jumping every whatever? First of all, you're not even going to be around for someone like Deep to bet on you. And the other part of that is that most opportunities, especially young in your career, someone has to take a chance on you. Like, someone took a chance on me. My dad took a chance on me. The person in, you know, Hewlett Packard took a chance on me. My brother in Sequoia in Excel took a chance on me. And it only came over time. It wasn't that I was going to create something or I was going to come in at a different level. It was that someone would pull me up to that level and the next level and the next level. And that's what matters. So it's a deep answer to
it's good.
That question.
I mean, it's an important, I think one of the things that people ask all the time is, like, I think there's a lot of people dissatisfied in their job in some way, shape, or form, right? And they're trying to figure out, particularly when you're 22 to 25, 27, 28, like, you know that what you're doing isn't your life's work, right? But you're not exactly sure what it is. And people tell you follow your passion or don't follow your passion. You need to follow the path progress in the business that you're on and stay committed to something. And so I think having some of these lived experiences for people is just like, it's an impactful thing. And I struggle with the advice to give to people in that setting because I can tell my story. And that's maybe interesting, but, like, all those doors closed after I walked through them, right? And you can't replicate what I did. What I did was worked hard and, like, tried to glom on to people that would teach me.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a strategy. That's like a tactic that I actually execute.
Well, there is a strategy here that I think from something you said. I still don't feel like I'm doing my life's work. So, like, this concept that you're going to come out of school and, like, go follow your passion, like, that's really bad advice because it's work. Like, early days of Qualtrics sucked. It was work. It wasn't my passion. The amount of people I know in life that actually get to follow their true passion, like, and by the way, even in the MBA, I mean, I was talking to an agent couple months ago who had 20 players, and out of 20 players, half of them weren't happy, right? So if you look at...
You just get to new levels and then you look around and you compare yourself to someone else.
So this idea of, like, go follow your passion, I would never use the word passion. I would say follow something that is intriguing. And then, by the way, you're going to get in there and every job you do, including in the MBA, there's going to be half the things that you don't like about it. And when you're more senior in your career, you get to choose to offload some of those things to other people. And that's it. That's how this is going to go. The higher up you get, there's going to be more things you don't like, but you also have the ability to organize it because you are the one that can call the shots about who gets to do what. But there's no perfect thing.
One of the other things I heard you say is that your strategy will ultimately be wrong. Plan for things to take a little bit longer than you expect, which I think ties in to that. You can't be too prescriptive. It's somewhat at odds with the press release concept in the future, but, like, do you think just being nimble in your know where you're going, but nimble in your journey to get there. Is that the right takeaway?
Yeah, the way I look at it is like, so you've got that press release, you know where you're going, and you think it's going to go like this. But actually what's going to happen is you're going to take off and you're going to go and you're going to hit this like roadblock. You hit the ceiling. What happens is you have to slide over and then find the new ceiling. And then you're going to hit that. And then you're going to slide over. And there's a lot of pain throughout those three bumps. But then you look back and you got to the end of the press release. It looks like a straight line, but it was actually really like that. And that's just how it goes. Like, I don't remember one product, one website, one thing we've done where we launched it and it was exactly how we thought it would, even though we knew where we wanted it to be. Where we wanted to be was a chance to always come in and say, okay, are we on track or do we need to change the way we're doing? Most of the time, we need to change the way we're doing.
You gave a commencement speech at BYU that was centered around the concept of being all in that we can link in the show notes and I would encourage people to watch. What does being all in mean to you now? How do you think about that? And what advice do you give to people about being all in?
I mean, the concept, in that commencement speech was like, it was back to a little bit of the changing jobs every year, right? Like, nothing good that I have has come from not just burning that boat. I mean, we talked about a story earlier today where whether I did it or it was burned for me, when you don't have a backup plan, then you tend to operate and whatever you're working on or the situation actually tends to go a lot better. When we got rid of the RSN, that was scary. But once it happened, it wasn't a week before we'd figured out like how a bunch of different revenue and opportunity to go after that was way better. Now you couldn't give me that deal all over again if you tried. Like, but it wasn't until we burned it. All right, this is the new, let's go. And so I think there's that moment on how to get there. And I think you'll operate a lot better. If you're sitting there working at Qualtrics and you don't know whether you're going to be here long term or you're not thinking about that or you're like, I don't know, you're not going to perform well. If you decide you are, if you go into college and you say, well, no matter what, I'm graduating. I don't care. That's the rules. This is what's going to happen. I am going to graduate. There is no problem. Most people, that's kind of in their cards. They're saying, hey, I'm going to go commit for 4 years and we're going to go graduate. Are you going to go all in on the other things you're doing? You've already proven you can commit to 4 years to something. Like, can you do that? Can you commit to your job? Can you commit to this? Can you commit to that? And it's just this concept that you just operate better when you're 100% committed. And the problem is today's world, it seems like hedging is just the priority. Hedge, hedge, hedge.
Last one. I'm not even really sure what this means, but someone told me to ask you about riding a horse into your office building.
That's a funny story. I don't know why, but we had a sales goal once and we would always do random things.
What year is this?
This is like 2014. And we just wanted to celebrate somehow. And I don't know where the idea came from, but I didn't have a horse, but my brother knew a guy who was out of town and he knew his horse caretaker and he has this really, really expensive horse that he liked. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool to just take his horse and like bring it into our office? And so his caretaker came down with a horse. We backed it up to the door. We walked it in and like, we rode the horse through the office and we actually had a couple meetings. Instead of sitting on the chair, you sat on the horse. And
how many employees are you there?
That many. But I think the picture was more for the gentleman that we knew to tell him like the picture of us and him with someone on his horse was pretty funny. And it's still funny today. But it was great. It was a beautiful horse.
Ryan, thanks for doing this.
No, thanks. That was some incredible detail.